Welcome, Travis.
Thank you.
And we'll have some sound and video examples. That's going to kind of be the majority of the evening. But to get things started, so I wanted to, you know, I have a few questions that I want to just kind of get the ball rolling with. So I guess my first question is for you: how is it that you? How did it come about that you came to be so involved in this kind of multi-dimensional music, theater, performance experience as a composer?
It kind of happened very organically. Writing, like, when I started composing, it was very involved with, you know, sort of like Cajun stuff and Fluxus things. And all this kind of like, you know, text scores of like later people that kind of derive out of this stuff, and so there, and that was all stuff that had happened, in, you know, a long time ago.
Right.
And there was a desire to sort of draw on that, because that's what we were interested in, but also because it seemed like there wasn't a lot of that going on, and it seemed that a lot of people kind of like name check this stuff, but they weren't like. You know, you wouldn't necessarily go there and see like these kinds of influences like really in play. So we started doing, my wife and I, who's the writer and director, Cara Feely, we started doing these pieces together and finding ways to kind of like define theatricality that would involve, that would like expand the notion of that to include also, you know, musical performances, which are already expanded to include sort of theatrical action, and just like where these things are overlapping, and working within it. And we did a few pieces together, with some kind of like tentative steps towards that, and then started, sort of like working out ways of, because it's one thing, you know, there's a sort of like school of this kind of performance thing, is just like have a score, rehearse it maybe once, and then just kind of do the performance with like some stuff that you show up with, and then it goes away, which is, you know, fine, but it's a very like, you know, like down and dirty kind of way of performance. We want to do things that we like rehearse for weeks and weeks and weeks, and like have like more elements that are more developed. Not that it's like a, not that it has a greater value because of that reason, but because those were things that we were interested in,
right.
That I was interested in. Plus, then at a point, I started scoring text, and then the ways that I was working with text necessitated a certain amount of time to learn the thing, and be able to execute it. So then, like, we had, you know, it was just kind of like growing in its complexity, and it just kind of went on from there.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah. Well, good. Well, so let's just go back a little further. So arriving at the point, as you just described, mm-hmm. know, sort of organically working with Cara in these kind of post-Fluxus in, mm-hmm. scenarios, as it were.
Yeah.
So you originally came to music through, I understand you were like a wind player.
A saxophonist.
Saxophonist
originally, clarinet later on.
Right. So,
very involved with free jazz.
Right.
And, I mean, so whatever, that's a whole other conversation, but... improvised things. I mean, I played straight ahead jazz for a while, and then went from there to, like,
right.
you know, Dolphy and Ornette and stuff.
So you spent some time at the New School and the
yeah.
jazz program.
Yeah, I went between the two. Yeah, I mean, I spent a lot of time with Andrew Cyril, who was Cecil Taylor's mm-hmm. drummer.
Right.
Then I also took a lot of like harmony classes uptown. And, mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
Right, and then you went out to CalArts, and so mm-hmm. so is that? I mean, was it at CalArts where somehow you became more sort of, was that the beginning of your interest in this kind of Fluxus and more experimental field, or
it had started earlier. It had started when we were already here, and I'd been working with, you know, like I'd started exploring like Cajun Wolf, and actually I worked for Lamont Young for a year, although we only ever talked about saxophonists. We talked about, because he knew Eric Dolphy in L.A.
Right.
And he used to claim, I swear to God, I never believed him. Even if I believed him, I didn't believe the con. He used to claim that he beat out Eric Dolphy for like a chair in this
I think I've read that, but that might have been something that he promulgated entirely.
It might also have something to do with White and Black. I mean, I don't know, but you know, he's good. Lamont, you know, he was a great saxophonist when he was doing it. But so we would talk about that a lot. And you know, I knew who he was, but it was, you know, I wasn't like a Lamont Young fan working for him. It was just like a job.
Right. Well, certainly he's prominent in this Fluxus kind of more open-ended or...
Yeah, well, he rejected Fluxus, didn't he? So
yeah, but he made a major mark on that moment. And there's some lasting works.
But I was around all that stuff and kind of, you know, I mean, I was young. And then went out to CalArts and James Tenney had just started there. And I worked closely with him the whole time out there. And, you know, I mean, everybody knows him as like the tuning guy and the sort of like these Meta Hodos and all that stuff. But I mean, he was Carrie Schneeman's partner and was in Meet Joy and did music for like all these like multimedia pieces, and that's something that people don't really talk about too much. And he was a performer in Meet Joy. He was down there rolling around with the chicken and sausages.
Sure.
I remember Kara, who worked with George Lewis for a little bit, told George that, and George didn't know. George had no idea. He's, you know, wish he'd known that while Jim was alive, because it would have changed his perception of him. So I worked with Jim, and, you know, CalArts being the place it is, there was a lot of, you know, those kinds of...
Sure, a lot of multidisciplinary, cross...
Music circuses and all that kind of stuff, and you really, we went very deep into that kind of stuff.
So Kara was also at CalArts?
No, she was in LA doing theater things, but she was, you know, we were there.
I see. So I guess the evolution of your now full-blown company and project was sort of parallel.
Yeah,
we
had worked together. I'd done music for some of the shows. It was more like doing music for theater in a way, and then we went to Germany for a year.
Uh-huh.
I had a grant and went there, and we lived in Cologne, and when we were there we started performing together and doing little weird things, and then we moved back to New York after a year and kind of started going from there, and that's when we had to, you know, it was the era when you had to name your performance group.
So, the era.
Still in that era? I don't know. It's like, it feels like now you could just be like,
now as well.
I don't. Yeah, it's fucking horrible. Oh yeah, I have stickers.
Well, okay. So Object Collection. So that's the company, and it seems to me that you guys are really on a roll in the sense that you're just cranking out productions very regularly. Yeah. I mean, I have a hard time since I really became focused on Object Collection as a fan. Mm. You know, it's been hard for me to keep up with all that's going on, and just in the last 2 years, I mean, I'm still kind of digesting what I've seen. You know, No Hotel was the recent one, and then and then just prior to that, it seems was Actual One, which
in May,
which was
it was a crazy year,
which was a so Object Collection is a music performance theater group. Is that how we would call it?
Sure.
I'm pretty nail it down.
No, of course not. We're pretty happy with. I mean, like there was an era where like you you wouldn't necessarily call it music or you wouldn't necessarily call it theater or whatever. But like I'd rather just call it music and theater and like get on with it to the work. I don't really.
However, as we discussed, you know, in preparing for this evening. It's also opera. Some of them are operas.
Yeah.
No Hotel, for example.
No Hotel is an opera.
Was an opera.
Yeah.
And so, which is not which is not enormously significant, but nonetheless, it gave me pause to kind of consider what distinguishes in the body of this rather substantial body of work that the Object Collection is putting out there.
Yeah.
What brings one work to the level of being an opera, which it indisputably is, whereas another work, just even in this one calendar year, the actual piece was not an opera, whereas the No Hotel was an opera. I'm just curious how you think of it.
Well, I mean, it's more like a lateral thing than an elevated thing, I would think. It's not, I don't put one above the other. But I think it has more to do pretty strictly with just like the form of the thing. Mm-hmm. The way that for me, it had to do with the way that the text is treated. When I started like scoring all the text, even if it's scored speech, which much of it is, which I still consider singing because it's 2013 and, you know, Cage's songbooks happened, 40 years ago or whatever. So when that started happening, and also when the pieces kind of became, some of them, there was a kind of like a, that the entire piece was conceived of as a whole, as opposed to like a series of vignettes.
You mean in the case of No Hotel.
No Hotel, Prom Radicals, and Innova. Like there was a okay. Those are the three.
Right, I'm not familiar with all of them, but certainly No Hotel.
It's fine. But like those are the three, and they all are kind of like they have like a large form structure, which can be shifting and unstable. But like I guess that was when we started adopting that term, which we didn't take on lightly. I mean, it was not. You know, I wasn't comfortable with it for a while, but I you know, it's
right. Well, but whereas, yeah. So I'm sorry, without the benefit of hearing these works, or seeing them, we're going to experience some of that going forward. But just to kind of draw this out a little bit, so we're talking about the recent work, No Hotel, which is an opera, which as Travis explained, has a sort of an overall structure that is like an opera. It's sort of a coherent kind of arc, as it were, a dramatic arc.
Maybe an incoherent arc,
but it is an arc. It is
an arc.
And I can see that when, you know, I mean, obviously the form of No Hotel, the structure of it as the set and the scene evolves in a very logical, linear way, although you're not aware of it until some time later what's going on. Yeah. That's one aspect, but then another piece earlier in the year, the actual one, which was much more of a multimedia experience, most of which took place on a screen. Most of what the audience experienced was within the context of a single channel screen, which was showing material and imagery and experience that was happening in the next room, but it was all being projected in real time for the audience in a separate room. So this work was not an opera because to close that up a little bit.
Yeah, I mean it's not
because it was just a series of.
Well, it's not, and it's not a very like it's not a very like art world glamorous distinction, but like it has to do really for me with like. Is all, you know, how is the text being treated? Is it being scored? Is it all being scored? Is it all, you know, and sort of how is the piece, you know, where is it sort of being, like what frame are you putting around it? And that one, it just wasn't, it was a different thing. Yeah, it was a different thing. I don't know, what we called it, a live film?
It was definitely a live film.
Yeah.
But there, you know, there was a lot of, so these are two different types of object collection experience. So, which you bring the entire musical direction to. So, let's talk a little bit about your side of it. I mean, I know it's difficult to separate out in this type of work for sure. You know, separate the music from everything else that's going on because in the works of object collection, there's a lot going on. It's just incredible simultaneity of. You know, there's action with actors here. There's visuals in video, perhaps, or lighting. There's sets being manipulated. There's just a lot going on, so it's difficult to separate out. But nonetheless, you're responsible for the sound, and I want to get a little more insight into how you approach that and how it. I've read that at least in part, you adopt a process not unlike what the Cunningham Cage collaborations
sort of
pursued, which was to have two separately created works, you know, the visual work or the theater work and the sound work, and they're just done independently, and then they come together and they happen together simultaneously. That's one.
We've done that. It's not the only way. I mean, I think the Cage Cunningham thing has become a shorthand.
It's a way in.
It's a way in, and certainly they're great. They were great. It depends on the pieces, because sometimes, some of the compositions, musical compositions, don't have any sound. Sometimes it's object being manipulated, but it's a scored manipulation. Sometimes that has transient sound that comes out. Transient, that's not the right word.
Incidental
sound that like will result from it. Sometimes, I've had things that are devices turning on and off and some of that, so there's like lighting elements. And sometimes she'll work with things, not all the time, but there is quite a lot. I mean, the most salient thing is this kind of sense of overlap. Of overlap and sort of maximal activity. Focus is scattered throughout the whole thing.
Yes.
There are multiple processes going on at the same time.
Right.
I don't know. To me, that's always made. Sound is my domain, and it's much more. Stuff is spilling out onto one another.
Sure, that's clear.
And that's a thing that just we've been working on.
Right. But nonetheless, I mean, you do have in most cases, and certainly in the case of No Hotel, you had an ensemble.
Yeah, we had
musicians.
A band. Yeah, that's true.
Five musicians.
All true.
Guitars. There was at least one guitar.
Yeah, guitar, drums,
guitar, electronics.
Electronics, violin.
Yeah, so there is an ensemble of musicians, and there are certainly moments or passages or sections that are decidedly sonic.
No Hotel was more there was film, theater, and music, and they were sort of like we were on our own tracks.
Right.
There was some flexibility in terms of the way the text was being done and how the score was working. I mean, it just depends on the piece.
Sure. Yeah. But nonetheless, I mean, having seen several of these, one thing that stands out for me, and it certainly works and makes sense within the larger picture of object collection of the production, is, there's certain features of your compositions. Certainly the one that stands out for me is, there's a lot of intense, kind of noisy, explosive, almost punk rock kind of episodes that seem to be part of the strategy. That seems to be one, a device, as it were. So tell me about that. I mean, clearly it works within the larger thing, but what's going on, on the musical side in that way. I mean,
who doesn't like punk rock? it's essential. It's essential to. It was an essential thing, and there was a lot of parallel and mirrored movements, whether it's, like Last Exit with Peter Brotzman and Sonny Chirac, or, like we were talking about, like the early, Derek Bailey stuff, or, a lot of like the post-Darmstadt compositional things. I mean, like a lot of, I think that last year with the Cage Centennial, you didn't really see how aggressive a lot of Cage's music was. I mean, Cage had some phenomenally, you know what I'm saying, right? Like, there were a lot of polite Cage concerts, And it was fine. But like, there's another side of him that's like pretty full on. And so, I mean, there's, yes, like, I definitely, but it's not just, 1977 to 1981 era punk rock. There's a lot of other, strands that I think, contain those ingredients. And volume is essential. I mean, it has to be, sometimes it's just got to be fucking loud, doesn't it?
Sure. Well, and certainly in the whole experience of these pieces, it generally, it certainly is of a piece with so much of, you know, what's borderline chaos going on.
Well,
often, certainly a kind of dis.
We work pretty hard on that chaos. So.
Yeah, it's a kind of controlled disorientation.
Yeah.
Well, and then the other thing that stuck out for me, and again, it's largely in the domain of the music, although it's part of, it manifests in other parts of these productions, which is appropriation. There's a lot of appropriation, a lot of chopping off entire works by other musicians or entire texts by other writers.
Yep.
So that's a strategy. I wanna hear a little bit more about your feeling about that. I mean, I'm very interested in that myself.
Mm. Oh, really?
But,
oh, I didn't know.
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, among many other interests.
Yeah, sure.
But certainly, I have a strong interest in that. In juxtaposing and mashups, as it were. So what is it serving in your case? And what is the impetus for all that appropriation? There's a lot of it, it seems.
There is, and you see it a lot in the texts, certainly. But I mean, yeah, the music. But I mean, that's an old tactic in music.
Sure.
Dating back to whatever,
Macho?
Yeah, Macho and Louis Armstrong and Mozart and I mean all the fucking guys and
sure
and Cage. I mean a lot of
well,
you
that's
know.
More quotation.
Well, yeah, and I think that it's sort of it's definitely using a lot of these sort of visual art strategies of like putting things in a frame or shifting the thing, sometimes they are in the strictly musical sense sometimes they are. Repeated verbatim, but in a different context. It's sort of a I don't know. I mean, there's precursors. In the middle of the exact center point of Anova, which is a 3-hour opera, and it was a mirror form, and the center is so juvenile, but the center of it, we all stop. And we play Fuck School by The Replacements as loud as and completely on detuned instruments, not on our, we do that for it's like an 80 second song and then we just go back into the piece. That was that's like that whole axis
it all revolves around
Fuck School. So
and a Minnesota band.
And a Minnesota band.
That's right.
It's a good band.
Yeah. Sure.
We did other things. There's sections that are derived from Thelonious Monk transcriptions and playing back recordings of other pieces. Sometimes, right. Sometimes I acknowledge it. Sometimes I don't.
Right. And there's also pop culture stuff. I mean, The Replacements and Monk and all the way to Steve Miller.
Yes. And we ended with Steve Miller.
And I don't know what else, but there's quite a range. So that
there's a lot.
I remember that
we
actual one. I think we began with the Steve Miller band.
It began and ended with it, didn't it?
I think so.
Yeah.
Which
I don't know.
Which,
that was
which is as a special sort of it's a
yeah.
I mean, that's a different device.
Well, it's actually, in a way, it was actually a quote of Autechre, because Autechre did an 11-hour, DJ set when they released their album last year, and they kicked off the second day of it. They did two 11-hour things or something, I can't remember. They kicked off the second day of it with Steve Miller, and I was like, what the fuck is this? And, because I'm a big Autechre fan. And, it just started listening to the lyrics and kind of realized how, I don't know anything about Steve Miller, where he stands on things, but Actual One was very involved with, May 68 movement and sort of, the Actual One, the piece,
Actual
was with
one.
A lot of the content was sort of drawing from this May 68 sort of very revolutionary, in a hyper-industrialized Western society.
Yes.
That's that was the context of the piece, and so, what function that serves, and then listen to this Steve Miller thing where he's, where it's this just the most banal sounding, I guess it's a nice song, but I'd heard it a million years, but I never heard him talking explicitly about you know, proletarian revolution like he actually does in the lyrics, you know. So, you know, yeah, you know, he does. It's in there, and it's, I mean, so I thought that was interesting, and so we.
So for you, it has a few layers to it.
There's many layers. Yeah. So yeah, I always thought about Autechre when we played that.
Well, I thought it was apart from all of the references that it had for you or for me, despite all that, it had a certain kind of, a certain dramatic
it's a great opening.
It had a certain magic to it in context.
Well,
okay, so there's a lot. 68
is 68, no matter what they say.
So there is some literally some 68 reference in The Fly Like an Eagle by Steve Miller?
It was a couple of years after. I'm not going to go deep on Steve Miller, but I mean, like, it was a couple of years after. I mean, it was definitely like soaking in those juices.
Sure. Well, in any case, it has a lot of. I mean, there's all this appropriation to me when I hear it in a lot of, as it's commonly used in the art world and in some of the more sort of subversive musical uses, it has, you know, an effect of, you know, a kind of surrealism or a kind of hallucination, as it were, kind of like, what the hell is going on here? It's just like it really upsets a kind of things a little bit in a way that unpredictably, it brings unpredictability, and it seems to me that that's a big part of what you're going for in your scores, but in the whole work is a kind of destabilizing.
Certainly.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So that's a big part of how appropriation works in that case, I guess, or it's throwing this thing that has all of, that's loaded with all of this.
It has a rhetorical content. Yeah.
Like, what's it doing here?
But I'm pretty.
What does that mean?
It's true. I'm pretty convinced though that the other things contain that rhetorical baggage as well. So I agree with you. However, I feel that the other elements, musical elements, like I think the musical elements contain that from the get-go. So it doesn't, it isn't necessarily, like it's just another tool in the box that's kind of like stained with the same problems or benefits of all the other sort of like strategies. So I mean, you know, I don't know that there's a harsher rhetorical content to playing like a Steve Miller song than there is to, you know, playing a beautiful arpeggio on a piano or something. I mean, to me, that they both contain all these representations and echoes and all these sorts of things.
Yeah, well, these days it's hard not to to find material that doesn't have some echo of something.
Sure.
Okay. Well, great. Well, so you're gonna illuminate some of this stuff for us. You're gonna show us some of what we've been talking about.
Yeah.
It'll all start to make sense. But I guess before we move on to that, and we'll Travis will be sharing some excerpts and so on. We can continue to have conversation around that as we go forward. But I want to ask, you know, what's next? I mean, what are you working on now? And what direction are things taking?
We have a few things. We're involved in this Burroughs Centenary that James is organizing. We're doing a performance, a one-night thing at the Stone, which I have no idea what's going to be. So there's that. I can't say anything about that. We are doing we did a staging of Robert Ashley's Automatic Writing, which I don't know if you saw.
I didn't.
Okay.
I did not.
But we staged it, and we're taking that to the UK, and maybe elsewhere. And then Kara and I are going to Denmark to do one of our pieces there with like a Danish group, and then we are working on another piece for next fall winter, which is very early stages. I don't really know. I think it's going to draw on sort of a scratch orchestra sort of tactic. That's kind of all I've thought of so far.
The scratch orchestra being
the sort of cardu.
Amateur musicians trying to play normal.
Or normal musicians playing amateurly, as the case may be. So It's kind of a mixture of the two.
A little bit slightly off, kind of standard rep.
Yeah. So there's that's early stages, and it has to do with it's a piece that has to do with the October Revolution in Russia and the Eisenstein film and the art journal October. So it's kind of like drawing a line through these things. And that's almost starting to be written. So that's what's going on.
And where would that take place?
I haven't the faintest idea.
And so Travis is also, you're also curating a regular, I guess, a festival, as it were, or at least a cluster of concerts at the Incubator Arts.
Yeah, concerts. When there's money to do concerts, we do concerts.
Is there anything coming up in that?
Part of some of the Burroughs stuff is going to be happening there. James is going to be doing a piece there.
That's this season?
That is in spring? March, April, middle of April.
So we're skipping the fall at the Incubator Arts, I guess.
No, there's some stuff going. I mean, there's theatrical pieces there. There's not. The next concert there is in April. Performance.
Okay. Well, good. Well, thank you. And I guess we'll take a minute or so to get your set up, and we'll go from there. And I'll change the lighting.
Okay.
And, we'll
pour a little more wine.
Yes.